Welcome to the Holy Spirit's Curriculum of Joy podcast. My name is Wanneke Oberhuber. I'm your host. My guest today is Johanna von Svet. Hi.
Hi there, Wanneke. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure. It's a beautiful thing to join in walking each other home. That's what we're doing. So I would like to start with a question that I think is a very important question. How did you come to see the world the way you do today?
Thank you for that question. But before we do that, I would like to read a prayer, if that's okay with you. And it's from chapter 18. And it's about connecting with a brother. It's in the last paragraph of section 5, chapter 18. I desire this holy instant for myself, that I may share it with my brother, whom I love. It's not possible that I can have it without him, or he without me. Yet it is wholly possible for us to share it now. And so I choose this instant as the one to offer to the Holy Spirit, that his blessing may descend on us and keep us both in peace. Amen. All right, and now to your question. How did I come to see the world the way I see it now? I don't know. I don't know how I see the world. When talking about the world, how to put it? My view, if I would have to specify it, it's highly predicated on what the Course says. There is no world. And yet I live here. Yet I find myself bumping into stuff, talking to people, writing stuff, doing the dishes, etc., etc. The Course does tell us, Jesus in the Course does tell us, that it's a particularly unworthy denial to deny that you're here, because that would deny the power of the mind. So I don't do that. But I am very much aware that the world we live in is a dream world. It's an illusion. It's just like a nighttime dream. It seems real, but when you wake up, you tend to forget it. And when you do remember it, you're perfectly aware that it's not real. It was a nighttime dream. And so that is sort of how I like to look at the world. It is a projection of inner content of in the mind. And I do not have a private mind. All minds are connected. So it's a joint projection. It represents what humanity has going on in the mind collectively. And so I can't go home by myself. I need my brother and my brothers. And we're in this together. So it's not like I'm in my own little canoe sailing home. You're in this boat together. And so that's sort of like the way I look at it. And like I said, it's highly influenced by my study of the Course. I came upon the Course in the late 80s. And at first, when I first started reading it, it didn't make sense to me at all, but I was fascinated still. And I heard other people talk about it because at that time I was involved in the Edgar Cayce readings and in the foundation association that was founded on the basis of the Edgar Cayce readings. And of course, the miracles was mentioned there quite a bit in those circles. And at some point, Marianne Williamson's book in the early 90s came out, and I read that. And that's when I actually seriously started studying it on and off. And in the last 10 to 15 years, much, much, and much more seriously. And especially the last 2.5 years, I've been a really avid student of the Course, thanks to the Facebook group that I've been involved with. And so, like I said, the way I look at the world is predicated on what I understand the Course to be saying. That's how I should put it.
Yeah, it's a very, I've noticed you are very involved in, you know, you're the administrator of a huge group. You're involved with the Foundation for Inner Peace, right? And so how did that come to be part of your life? Because that's pretty, a lot of, let's put it, responsibility.
Actually, that happened happenstance. I wasn't a fan of Facebook at all. I actually had avoided Facebook for the longest time. And my study of the course and my study of the Edgar Cayce readings eventually led, like 7 or 8 years ago, to me consulting the Akashic Records for myself in a daily practice, sort of like intuitive writing, daily morning intuitive writing. And I made a website to record some of what I was receiving. And at some point I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a Facebook group and to post it there and see if people are interested? Because, you know, a website, some people find it, but it's it doesn't give you a lot of exposure unless you do a lot of marketing. And so I thought, let's go on Facebook. I'll just side pass my my objections to Facebook, and I'll just start a group and look at the workbook lessons, mainly the workbook lesson, because I had been getting information in those intuitive writing sessions about the workbook. And so I started a work group, and, you know, a couple of people joined, and it was looking good. And I myself joined a couple of other groups, course groups, just to see how Facebook groups operate, out of curiosity. And one of them was the FIP Facebook group, Let's Discuss A Course in Miracles. After a week or so, I thought, I found my objections against Facebook confirmed, and I left all of the groups except the Facebook group by the foundation, because I had such a fond link to the foundation, because I was so grateful for them holding the light of the publication A Course in Miracles for the world to see. And so I thought, I'm not going to leave their group, I'm going to stay there. So I became active in the group as a member. And on the side, I was developing my own Facebook group. But then within 3 months, I was blocked by Facebook for my own group. My own group, I couldn't access anymore. I think I had like 100 members or so. But I was blocked, and there's no way I could find my way back into my own group. And so here I was with just this membership of the Facebook group by the foundation. And I thought, well, I might as well leave that too, because, you know, if I can get access my own group, the whole exercise is for nothing. But at that time, there was a post in the group, in the Facebook group by the foundation, asking for volunteers in a technical fashion. They wanted people who were technically skilled in social media. I wasn't at all. I'd been avoiding Facebook. But I thought, well, this is an opening. I'm just going to tell them what my experience is. And maybe they have another type of job. I had recently retired, so I had some time on my hands. And so I applied, answering their call for volunteers. I didn't hear anything for the 2 or 3 weeks, but I thought, I'll stay on the group. Who knows what answer I'll get. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, I was granted an interview with one of the staff members. And she said, well, it's not a problem that you're not too skilled in social media. We need people in the back room to process email addresses and stuff like that. Can you do that? So sure, I can process email addresses, not a problem. So I started doing that, processing email addresses of people who applied to become a member of the Facebook group. So that sort of hooked me on the Facebook group, because I had to get access to the back room of the Facebook group. And so they made me an admin in order that I could process those email addresses. And that went on for like maybe a month or so. And at some point they invited me for a moderator meeting and said, well, there must be a mistake. I'm not a moderator, I'm just a member, and I process these email addresses, and that's all I do. But no, it's not a mistake. You're most welcome to be in the moderator meeting. And from then on, I was a moderator. So it was, I don't know, Holy Spirit influence, I suppose. And I was, of course, very humbled and honored to be asked to do that. And the people I met, it was wonderful. The other moderators, because it's not a one-person job. Right now, we've got 4 active moderators. There's a couple of other people who are admins, and they work in the back room, you know, technical aspects of running a Facebook group. But the 4 moderators are the ones who read about the posts and who involve themselves with what's happening in the group. And it's been eye-opening, I have to say. It's wonderful. It's been a wonderful experience. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds like a big journey from having a tiny, according to Facebook ideas, a small group, right? And then not being able to do it, and then being being an admin in a huge group. Yeah, fascinating.
I couldn't have planned that. I mean, and it wasn't my intention at all. When I joined that group, I actually wanted to just see how a group is run, because I wanted to do my own group, right? But when that didn't happen, and I sort of liked what they were doing, and I had a fond, I felt affection for the Foundation for Inner Peace, because ever since I bought the book in the late 80s, I'd been studying it on and off, and I felt this huge appreciation for this little outfit that would just publish this one book. And that was the whole reason for existence, this one book. And to me, it was mind-blowing what was in there. And so for me to do something back, that was very important. So I was really happy that the opportunity presented itself. And as far as my experience goes, I in my working life, I was a high school English teacher, English as a second language. So I was used to managing classes of unruly 16 to 18 year olds, so it's not very different from from managing a large Facebook group. Plus, in the days that I was really actively studying the Casey readings, I still am, but a while back I was a bit more active, and there was this one online Casey study group right when the internet had come up, had started out, like in 97, 98 or something. There was a net search for God, it was called. And I was a member of that group, which was the one and only at the time, Edgar Casey internet study group. And after a while, they asked me to be a moderator there too. So I had that as an experience of moderating. It was a small group, but still, you know, it was some of the skills that I learned there together with the other moderators came in handy in this position.
Yeah. So you shared how you see the world in a very different way than I suspect you saw it before, that you take responsibility for what you see. And
I think that's the crucial idea, because if you say, well, the world is an illusion, who cares, then you don't, you know, there's no responsibility. That's not the right conclusion. The world I see and is a reflection of what's going on in my mind. And if I don't like what I see, then the place to change it is in my mind. And that's a radical teaching, really, because there are no exceptions. And I'm thinking of, maybe I should give an example, but I don't think that's necessary. It's just that everything that happens in a day is reflective of my state of mind. The outer picture is a reflection of the inner content. And when I'm upset or when I don't feel well or have physical symptoms or whatever, it's all a reflection of what's going on in the mind. And it's the mind where is the place where that needs to be addressed and that needs to be healed. And when the mind is healed, that reflects in an improved picture. But I don't know ahead of time in what way the improvement, what the improvement is going to look like. And so currently in the Facebook group, there's a big discussion about, shouldn't we all have healthy bodies because we're doing the course, and, you know, shouldn't we be able to heal our body? And to me, that's sort of like an ego ruse. We're not supposed to look for proof of reality in the illusion. And the reality is that we are an idea in the mind of God. And the reality is that we share one mind. It's not really sharing. There is only one mind, and part of the mind split off and in many millions of pieces, and each piece thinks it's separate and apart and individual and unique. But that's a misunderstanding. We're all the same. And if you put that view next to the worldly view of individualism and making a career for yourself and making a life for yourself, it's very different, very, very different. And so Ken Wapnick says, be normal in the world. And so I try to remember that. Just be normal in the world, do what everybody does, but at the same time, know that my salvation is not in the world. And know that kindness created me kind, love created me loving, peace created me peaceful. And so did peace and love and kindness create everybody else. And the way to find my way home is to keep that in mind when interacting with my brother. Because we are all identified with a split mind to some extent. Some people more than others, but everybody is to some extent, or they wouldn't be here. And the way home is to recognize the light in a brother and address the light in the other, and only see the light. And so that's my job, and that's my responsibility. And everything that happens in the world is either showing me that love is all there is, because I see the love and experience the reflection of love, or it is a call for love. The call for love in a situation that I observe. And because it's a reflection of my own mind, it's my own call for love. So it's sort of like a double call for love. And if something is purely love, or if something is a call for love, either way, the only sane way to respond is lovingly. So that sort of takes care of all discussions. It's really rather straightforward. It's not simple, but it's rather straightforward.
Yeah, it's an important thing to say, to remind oneself that we are one, that it's one mind, and we're all thinking the same thing, so to speak, or the same thought. And that's a big thing to realize, that there's one thought going on. It's not a thousand thoughts. It's one thought. And it's a whole thought, a complete thought. Even though it appears as if it were many thoughts, it's not. It's one thought, and it all belongs together. And therefore, I always like to say, you know, we forget that we are understood. Because, you know, we're encountering all these so-called others and this and that in the world, and then we think they don't understand us, or we think we can't understand them. So we're forgetting that we are actually understood.
I like the way you put that. And you refer, I suppose, to the two levels, right? The two levels of understanding. there's the one level, the non-dual level, the level of oneness, of reality, of the kingdom, of heaven, of knowledge, where everything is one and it's only one idea and that's who we are. And there's level two, the level of the dream, of the mistake that was believed to be true. And in that illusory world, which is still very abstract, it's illusion in thinking. And that's called that's called level two. In that level two, there is great diversity, and people do think that they're separate and apart and everything, and that minds are split and that there are many thoughts, but that's not our reality. That's the delusion that we are in, and how to get from the delusion to the reality, and that's the bridge that the Course in Miracles offers. And of course the main part of that is forgiveness, letting go of my take, letting go of my limited assessment of what things are, what they're for, and what they mean, and what the best way forward is, letting go of all that, and knowing that what somebody else does and believes or mistakenly is convinced of is not true. It's just like a nighttime dream. I won't get angry at the figures in my nighttime dream once I'm awake, because I know it never happened. It's not true. It's just an imagination. And so it is with this world. Doesn't make it easy. You know, even though I know this to be true, I often fall for the drama in the moment. So, and that's where the work is, the drama in the moment, being hooked by, triggered by circumstances or happenings. And that's when we have to stop our engagement and drop our emotional investment and ask to be shown. That's the work that is based on a little willingness, on the willingness to see things differently. I was just reading about that today, also chapter 18. Little willingness, so important.
Yeah, so important to be willing to change one's mind. Yeah, that's something to ponder on. So when you ask, can you please help me to change my mind? Because we know we're unhappy with something. That means we're thinking about it in a way that isn't helpful, that is harmful to us, or where we don't feel comfortable with. That's why we ask for the help to change our minds. How do you do that?
I received in this intuitive writing a very helpful stepwise process to do that. First, I have to look at what's happening. I can't ask the Holy Spirit or Jesus or the internal teacher, whatever you want to call it, to change my mind if I don't know what's going on. So I have to look at it. What's going on? And then I have to acknowledge that apparently this, what I'm looking at, is going on. So looking at and acknowledging comes first. And then instead of wallowing or complaining, what I need to do is stop my habitual way of interacting with it and drop the emotional charge I've given it. So it's look at, acknowledge, stop, drop. And then there's room to ask. Ask to see things differently, to see with the eyes of love. And then I trust that the answer is already given, because it is. The Course explains that this was all over long ago. You're just reviewing, and it's an invitation to look at everything with the Holy Spirit. So I trust that the answer is already there, and I will see it. I can't say it will be given, because it's already given, I will see it when, at the time that's most beneficial to, for myself and those that are connected to me. And I don't know exactly how and when, but that's the trust, that's the faith. So it's look, acknowledge, stop, drop, ask, and trust. That's what I do. And it might sound a bit complicated, but it gets easier to remember with practice. And it's got an acronym, LASDAT, last that. Look, acknowledge, stop, drop, ask, and trust. And it works wonderful. I can literally say it works miracles, because when I do that, I feel relief right away, most of the time. There will be occasions when I don't feel relief, and then I'll have to do it again, and I'll do it again. Not because it didn't work, but because I'm worrying too much and my mind is too crowded. But the whole procedure, the whole stepwise sequence is predicated on willingness, my willingness to change. And that's really the crucial part in it. I remember in one of the Zoom conversations we had with the volunteer group of the foundation, at the time when Judith Scotch was still living, and she was part of that. She enjoyed being, you know, part of the weekly Zoom hour with the volunteers. And of course, we talked about, you know, what is forgiveness and how do you let go and how do you ask and stuff like that. And she said, well, sometimes it's, you know, you can make it very complicated, she said, but sometimes it's just, I forget all the theory and I just go, help! And then from the mouth of Judy Scott-Whitson, that was really hilarious too. I mean, she was so eloquent and she knew so much. And to hear her just say that she calls out for help and that does it for her, I thought that was wonderful. So I've kept that in mind too. So if I can't find the peace in myself to take these steps, I just say help. And then at a later moment, when I reflect, I look at it, I acknowledge it, I stop interacting with it the way I'm have accustomed myself to. And I drop my emotional charge. I ask to see differently. I trust that the answer is given. Yeah, that's my process.
So there's the trust aspect of it. How did you come to see that as an option?
That's actually crucial, because if you do not find the place of faith and trust inside, then easily worrying thoughts come back in. And so it's sort of like they stave off the worry and the anxiety, the trust. And so it's important to call on trust, because of my own little self, I don't have trust. It's a gift. Trust is a gift. And I have to ask for it. And I have to make room in my mind, just like the answer to the question, I have to make room in my mind to receive it. And if I keep on thinking worrying thoughts and engaging with the problem in the same old way, there's no room for trust to grow. And so it's a beautiful thing, really, trust, because it will carry you through situations where it isn't obvious how to proceed, which, you know, will happen quite a bit. And so if the faith muscle has been worked and has been developed, that's something to fall back on, which is really, really wonderful. And that's not something that happens in one day, that's something that develops over time, is my experience.
Maybe you'd like to share a trust story of yours.
I suppose raising kids is an area where trust is really, really important. And it's been in my experience. My husband and I have three boys. They're in their 30s now, so they have their own families and they've moved out far away, etc. So they're on their own. But when they were growing, and when we were raising them, it was extremely important for my own peace of mind to trust that their inner guidance would guide them. And it was also important to be trustful towards them, to give them the trust that I felt, and not to second guess them or to be worried that I saw other parents do, but to radiate trust towards them, because then that helped them grow. I was convinced that helped them grow. And I, as a mom, would trust how they developed and trust their judgment and trust that they would choose what would be best for them and the ones that they were in contact with. So I would say raising children is one area in which trust was very palpable in my experience. In other areas, I think it's still developing. I suppose with raising kids, that was something so close to my heart. I don't know. I must have done it in other lifetimes because it was something that felt so natural to me. Whereas in other challenges that I've had, I'm groping in the dark often, and so I have to borrow from the trust that I felt in that area. Let me see. Yeah, and as an example of how that stop, drop, ask, and trust, how that works. I remember not so long ago, I think it was 2021, when the pandemic was still in full swing, my youngest son and his girlfriend wanted to get married, and there was still chance of getting infected. And my husband and I, my husband's over 70, I'm 65, and my husband wasn't vaccinated. I was, but because he wasn't, I had to live as if I wasn't vaccinated, because, you know, he wasn't vaccinated. Anyway, and the wedding ceremony was a small affair, and I wanted to be present because, you know, it's my son. And but then on the other hand, I didn't want to risk taking back the virus home and infecting my husband. So I was in a bind. I didn't know what to do. And so I did the stop, drop, ask, and trust. I knew full well what was going on. You know, I looked at it, I acknowledged my distress. And I stopped fretting about it. I dropped my emotional investment in it. And that created space in my mind to ask the question, please show me what love sees. And I trusted that the answer was given. And almost right away, I got the answer, love conquers all. There is no way your son would blame you for anything, or that your son would think, my son would think that I didn't love him enough if I didn't come. And so in the end, we had a conversation, and he fully understood. It was no problem at all. And he had a small ceremony with a couple of friends, and they had a good time, and it was fine. The other parents weren't there either. So it was just their generation. And I was afraid that if I didn't show up, it would be something that would stand between us, you know, for the years to come. It proved not to be the case at all. It was perfectly fine. And so that was to me, that was a miracle at the time, because I was so stressed over it. And all of a sudden, all the anxiety left me. That was really beautiful.
Yeah, that certainly was an unexpected answer, right? Because I think it's often very unexpected what the answer is that comes from trust. So you probably have more stories about that.
The thing is, I tend to forget. That sounds very ungrateful, but I tend to forget what the grievance or the what the problem was. I remember another example, recent example, that I was in a meeting with several people, and this one person, you know, meeting like a regular meeting, so we would meet once a week, and this one person would take the stage and keep on talking. Whereas I felt, you know, he should evenly share the minutes of the hour that we were together. And it started to really trigger me that this person would just call the attention to himself. And then at one time, another person in the group shared something that was very heartfelt. And I felt that what she had shared needed some space to just be received by everybody. But there, this person went again, and he drew the limelight back to himself and told us a similar story that had happened to him. And all of a sudden, it was all about him. And I couldn't listen to it. I felt so distressed. And so afterwards, I did the look at, acknowledge, ask. Now, stop, drop, ask, and trust. And then it occurred to me, and I talked to somebody about it too, because I wasn't really sure how. This was one of the things the instances that I was not able to get to a resolution by myself. So I asked somebody to help me. And she actually said, you know, the world has given you to forgive. So that the most important part of this whole meeting is perhaps not the story that this person was telling, but the fact that you have an opportunity to forgive, to see that it's not real. And I thought that was really profound. And then the other thing that the other person said is that perhaps the one who had shared her heartfelt story was glad that the limelight was directed to somebody else, because she had shared from her heart, and maybe she was happy that it wasn't no longer on her. And it never occurred to me that could be the case. And so those two things together just relieved me so much. And since then, the meetings have been very similar. There hasn't been no change. That person is still taking the limelight more so than others, but it hasn't bothered me at all. I'm just happy for him to tell, you know, what to share, what he has to share. And I'm happy for him that he finds it. Welcome audience to share his stories with. So that's another example. Yeah, and trusting, because in this case, trusting that the answer is already there, because the other people weren't triggered at all. Nobody else in the circle was bothered by it. It was just me. So the answer was there already. They were already benefiting from what the answer was that I didn't see. And so That was a very helpful experience for me. Very helpful.
I think that's really fascinating to see how these things that you get triggered by can be seen differently, that you can actually change your mind about it. Because, you know, this is something that you could hold a grievance about for the rest of your life, about everyone who steps and doesn't let other people shine, or whatever you were thinking was happening, right? This is something that happens all the time. there are people who speak more. They refer to themselves as the central story and so on. That's going to happen all the time. So I don't think that's something that gets lost. I think that's something that's very useful to have forgiven, because you have it all the time.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And what I was shown actually was that it's not real. It's a call for love. And whose call is it? That person's call, but also my own call, because I think it's real. So I'm investing in an illusion, thinking that should do that. So that's my call for love. So it's a double call for love, and it helps to know that the world is not real. And what is real is the light in everybody, the light in that person, the light in me, the part, the light in the circle that we have. And once you get to that, you're able to lift from the battleground, as it were, and feel that the light shared, that's our reality. Then, you know, it's not a problem at all. And that's what I meant, where sometimes I forget what the grievance was, because it's no longer there. It's difficult to bring it back to mind. Yeah. Interesting how that works, huh? It's like in the Bible, there's this sentence that the Son of God or the Lamb who washes away the sins of the world. And that's what I think of when it washes away the sins of the world. That's what happens. It dissolves and you forget what it was. Just like a nighttime dream. You wake up and you think, what was that dream again? And then, little segments I might remember. And then after breakfast and I try to recall the dream, it's totally gone. I can't remember the dream. And so it is with these grievances. They just dissolve. Because you've looked at it from the position of the light, and the light has shown it away, which is something to be very grateful for. Because with it is the distress gone. So distress is a great motivator.
Yeah, I think that's so beautiful to recognize that we are the ones who are having a grievance with it. The thing that we think is happening there may not be happening at all. And there's totally different perspectives on it, right? And the Holy Spirit always has a perspective that brings peace. And that's something that I think that's part of the trust journey that you were speaking of, to be certain there is a perspective that is peaceful, even when you don't see it.
Brings to mind another happening or event last summer, so about a year ago. I was walking the dog in the fields. We were on holiday in Poland, actually. And there was this area, barren fields, you know, sometimes they grow stuff there, but not every year. So this year there was nothing there. So barren fields, tree here and there. And the dog was running. And all of a sudden I saw this deer darting in one direction. And I was looking at it. And then two small fawns were darting the other way. So the mother had tried to distract us by going one way, and the two fawns were running the other way. But my dog hadn't seen the deer, so he went after the fawns. And I called him, and the fawns were no game for him because they were way faster than he was. So I wasn't too scared. I mean, it was a bit of a startling situation. But then one of the fawns got hooked by some barbed wire that was lying there, and it fell down and it died instantly. And I felt so bad, because here I was minding my own business with my dog, and all of a sudden I had this dead fawn right next to me. And so I prayed, please let me see this differently. because I was very, very distraught. And it took a couple of days to have that dissolve. I can't remember exactly what the perspective was that allowed me to see it differently, other than, but it helped, because I cannot call back to memory the distress I felt. I don't feel that distress anymore. So anyway, I think it was sort of like the essence of the aliveness of the animal, the essence still there. Maybe not in this form of this one form, but the essence of aliveness is still there. And the essence of love that the mother deer has for her children, something that the Course actually talks about, is still there. And so it is the form that I was upset about. And I know that the form is an expression or a reflection of something that goes on in me. And so, it was a difficult one to get to a different place inside so that I didn't feel the distress. I felt guilty too. And of course, guilt is a major theme in the Course. You feel guilty for having done the unspeakable. And here it was, this innocent fawn lying dead on the floor, on the ground. And I felt guilty. Yeah. So it's challenging sometimes.
Let's pick up on the unspeakable. So one believes one has done something that is unspeakable. And then we have the other perspective that we actually are one and we don't have any private thoughts. There's nothing that is private because we're all joined in thought. So there is nothing that is unspeakable other than in our mind of thinking that it's totally terrible and awful and this and that. So I think that's a very important point that you made there.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, because of the oneness. The Son of God is innocent. The last judgment is the Son of God is innocent. You're innocent. And why are we innocent? Because we are the idea of love. We are the idea, the thought of peace, the thought of joy, the thought of freedom. And so a thought of freedom, if there's only a tiny bit of captivity in that idea, it's no longer freedom. So it's very abstract, but it's very pure because of its abstract. And due to our misunderstanding, the tiny mad idea, etc., etc., we are in a world of concreteness with shades and divisions and everything. And so the purity of freedom is unknown in our world. And the purity of peace is unknown. There's always some strife, some cruelty going on somewhere. Whereas we are abstract ideas in the mind of God. And there's this one section in the Course that speaks of an arc of golden light that spans above whatever it is that we're looking at. And that's such a hopeful image to me, because I think even though that is still concrete, I mean, an arc of light, it points to the abstractness of what we are. And we are totally innocent. We are perfect, holy ideas. And in that, we are unified. And so whenever there's a problem, I try to get from the plane of the problem, the seeming problem, to the plane of the unity of the abstract idea of light and love and joy and freedom, and come from that place when interacting with the situation. And of course, asking for guidance, to say what to do. the helpfulness prayer is on my mind a lot. You know, in chapter 2.
I know the prayer that was given for Bill Thetford to be able to speak at a conference where he didn't know exactly what to say or what to do and why he was chosen to be there. Yes, I do remember that. And it's a very important prayer in the Course in Miracles. Yeah. I think once again, the thing of trusting there is a solution, or the solution has already been given, right? There is no problem anymore in truth. I think that's a very important point to think of, because many people are experiencing total devastation in their minds. And they think there's nothing they can do that would make anything better, right? This despair, as one calls it. And this idea that it's all solved, right, is a pointer that there is a way out of that state of mind in which you think there is no way. There is nothing left. You can't do anything. You've tried everything. Nothing has worked. Nobody understands you. You hate yourself for what you did. You feel guilty for it all. And so I think this idea that there is a solution and that you're innocent and your holiness has not changed, right? It's totally fascinating. And I think another way of putting it, it's taboo to say that all is solved. But it is. It's a taboo to say that all is solved. It's all is okay, right? Because so many people get angry about it. Like you were saying, you know, you can't discount the world you see, even though it's a dream, you can't discount it, because that's terrible to discount it, right? But nonetheless, the idea that all is solved is important. It doesn't mean you shouldn't recognize what's going on in the world you see.
I agree, absolutely. It's kindle for the fire, right? Kindle for the light of the fire. It's the fuel for the motor. Yeah. And it's to say that it's not real and that it's that the solution is already there. The thing is, what makes you able to tune into that solution that's already there is the space you make in your mind. And how do you make space in your mind? By letting go of your own tape. And that's so hard, because if you feel desperate and you've tried everything, I mean, it's so hard to let go of that last bit of desperate knowledge that you think you have of whatever it is that you're worried about. But that's actually what needs to happen, is to make room in your mind. And that's what the little willingness speaks to. Little willingness to be shown another way. And to let go of what the limited mind knows, or thinks it knows. Yeah, it's been solved. Yeah, I find that very comforting. And it makes me think of, there's only one problem, and there's only one answer. I love that too. You know, so many different problems, so many different aspects, and so variety and myriad ways of et cetera, et cetera. There's only one problem, the belief in separation. And there's only one solution, to accept the atonement for yourself. That's the course, that's the practice. And I love the Son of God is innocent. There's one lesson that it says, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God. A while back, I practiced saying that to everybody I would meet in the airport or on the street, in the shop, wherever I would go, and I would see people, I would think to myself, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God. And I found that it wasn't always easy to actually mean it, because I had judgments, like, you know, that person looks funny, or I'm not going to say to that person because, you know, they're up to no good. Who am I to think even those types of thoughts? That's just the ego getting room to spin its wheels. And so to just say to everybody that you meet silently in your head, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God. It's just so freeing, so creates so much space inside. It's wonderful, wonderful. Even better than saying, I bless you, Holy Son of God. Best is to say together, give me your blessing, Holy Son of God. I bless you, Holy Son of God. What else needs that? Is there to be said? That's all that needs to be said. The rest is superfluous.
I think it's so funny, you know, how in the world there's infinite solutions, right? Infinite amounts of solution, but they're all separation thinking. Right? So you think you found a new solution to your problem, but it's not. It's the same solution under a different guise, a different image, a different look, right? But it's the same thing because it has the same feeling to it, right? In reality, right? A short-lived thing that you do and then it feels like you've solved it, and then immediately you recognize there was no solution. It didn't solve it. Very shortly afterwards, so very short-lived. And the solution of joining or oneness is a long-lived one, because once you are able to see that as the status quo, things shift for you, and that's a lasting shift. I'm not saying that I'm there yet or anything. I'm just saying that it's but I do notice that every time it happens, and when you have a shift in that direction, it's a one that feels right, while the other ones, they're very short-lived, the ones that are guided by separation thinking. So you might have this triumph, yay, I did it, I managed, I won, right, or whatever, but it doesn't last.
No, I totally agree with that that conclusion. And the thing is, once you've arrived at the one answer that gives relief and that gives space and freedom, like I said before, what the problem that was there before dissolves, and it's no longer there. It's gone. And that's so miraculously lovely to experience. But like you said, as long as we are in the world, we bump up against these issues that do bother us, and that make us realize we're not in that place the whole time. And so that's the work, that's what we're doing. That's the course practice, and I think it continues on. I don't know how, you know. I often hear people say, like, "So when will I be enlightened?" We will be enlightened till we're all enlightened. It happens for all of us, or it happens for no one, because we're one. And so I don't fret about it. I don't worry about it too much. Carpe diem. And I'm very fortunate to be able to say that and mean it too. I count my blessings very often.
Yeah, so now I think there's a big connection between the oneness and the trust. Because we're so used to distrusting. We've been told, you know, distrust anyone, right? and don't believe anything they say, just, you know, this and that. And then we have the, you know, in A Course in Miracles, it says it's all about an experience. It's not about the words, or it's not about the practices. It's not about the form. It's actually about the message. So the message can come in infinite forms, the same message. And so the message of separation can come in infinite forms, whereby there is a limit to that, because you can't completely eliminate the oneness thought. But there is no limit to the oneness thought, because that one is total. As it says in A Course in Miracles, there's no that. So the other one that has a limit, so you can't get lost, in other words.
The problem, of course, is we think we get lost. We think that's the illusion. It's the dichotomy. I mean, nothing's wrong, but we think something's wrong. And there's nothing to distrust, but still we distrust. So there's this duality thing going on. And how to get yourself from thinking in opposites, and thinking in negative and positive, and thinking in oneness. And that's where the atonement comes in, and the perspective of the Holy Spirit. And that's what our task is, each and every time, every minute of the day, almost. And that's actually with the going back to the Facebook group, that's what happens in the Facebook group too. It's just like any other gathering of people. They quarrel or they disagree, and that's all fine. But the basis of it all is to discuss, is to see your brother as yourself. That's the whole idea. You're walking each other home. And even if you do disagree, that's fine, because that's just form that happens in form. But we know that we're one. And we know that we're all children of the same Father. And so that's what carries us through. At least that's how I look at it.
Yeah, A Course in Miracles has so many ways of allowing you to see that. You know, the fun thing, you know, it has this way of saying, okay, these few words explain the whole Course in Miracles. Just read them. If you understand it, or if it becomes your experience, you don't have to read anything of the book, right? You've got it, right? So I think that's really funny, you know, and then you have thousands of pages of written words come after that. So that's sort of like the whole thing, you know, you have the solution, and okay, you want to have the experience, you don't have it yet. Okay, there's a thousand ways of getting you there, or many more. I don't know how many, right? But it's already there. It puts the solution first. And that's why, you know, I say, okay, there's actually a therapy form that's called the solution-focused brief therapy, right? But A Course in Miracles puts the solution first. And I think that's something that both have in common. The solution is first. And the solution may have nothing to do with the perceived problem at all. And that's what they say. In the solution-focused brief therapy, they speak about how the solution may have nothing. It doesn't have to have anything to do with what the problem is, right? In that case, it doesn't say the perceived problem, it says the problem, right? So the solution can be something totally different. And so the focus is on the solution. not that you look away from the issues or whatever. On the contrary, you're able to look at them because you put the solution first.
Very different from the way the world goes about it, huh? It sort of delves into the problem, and it delves into the causes and you know, other people's roles in it, et cetera, et cetera. And whereas the course is very clear, what is your goal? And the goal, once you put the goal up front, then the path to it will be made clear. And because love makes it so. Love is a very dynamic element. And the way I like to look at all, you know, that the problems can be so varied is I like to have the image in my mind of a mountain with, you know, with many trails starting in at a lot of different places around the mountain, and all the trails are different and the length is different, but they all lead to the same summit. And so when you approach the mountain from the north, you have to go south, but if you approach the mountain from the south, you have to go north. So if you start talking to somebody who's telling how they're going south and you're going north, he's wrong, you know, he's going south. He should be going north. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The idea is the summit. The goal is the summit, which is the thing. And so in form, it can be different, but the goal is not defined in form. But as long as we live here, we have to deal with form. So we do the best we can, inspired as we are and as we ask to be.
I think there's one could make up a few images for it. You know, you're already at the solution, then you try to run away. You know, but it turns out there's a rubber band on you. Every time you get further away, the faster you return, where it pulls you back, and then you might get to a tree where you can hold on, and then you go back, you start running away again. But one day, the rubber band will be able to pull you all the way back.
To remember that analogy, that's great. The rubber band, yeah, the solution is already there. It has a rubber band. Yeah, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful image. Yeah, exactly. And the fact that the course is so long, it's because it describes all these various movements of the band of the rubber band, or the various trails in the circumference of the mountain, you know, the various trails that are there. And so that's why some passages speak to some people and some other passages speak to other people. It's like a symphony with many themes in it and lots of variations on the themes. But in the end, it's one symphony with one message. And so whatever theme you travel on, it'll get you there. So that's the beauty of that document. It's really awesome. Really awesome. But it's been, yay.
Yeah, it's the one song. Actually, only one lyrics. We're all singing the same words. But we think we're singing something else than the other person. So we can't even hear them. And then suddenly, and then there's moments where we hear, oh, there's other people singing the same thing. What? I thought I was singing alone. I have to be special. I have to be the only one singing that song.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to be the one who invented these lyrics. Yeah. But how can they be singing the same thing at the same time with no time lag, nothing? Then I can't have been the one who invented it. It must be something bigger than that. So you get all these So you're always wondering what's going on here, right? Because you're actually not singing alone. Everyone's singing the same words, the same melody, and it all fits together.
When you do discover that, the journey becomes much faster too, because then you're together. So that's really the saving grace, I think.
That's the question. Is the journey faster, or we're just realizing that we're journeying together, and that it's not, then you don't have a feeling of it being too slow or too fast?
Yeah, exactly. Or
it just feels right. It just feels perfect the way it is.
Yeah.
Is my guess. It's so much to think about it, because I've, you know, this, we're singing together, we're singing the same words, and it all sounds together, and it's perfect the way it is. And the speed no longer is of issue, because before you're like, I have to be ahead of someone, or I'm lagging behind, or I'm the one who's making it up so nobody else can be heard. That can't be that anyone else is singing the same thing and all these things. But once you get comfortable with everyone singing the same thing and it's all fitting together and it's beautiful, then you get comfortable with the absolute beauty of it and the absolute joy of it. And then none of the considerations you had before about it are relevant anymore.
Yeah,
you're just immersed in the joy.
And so as long as you're resisting or competing, that's when, you know, the time element still plays. Yeah. No, I get that's a nice metaphor, a chorus or an orchestra. Yeah.
Would you like to share one of those, about one of the experiences you had where that became so apparent to you?
Yeah, you're all singing the same song. I suppose it's not one particular circumstance or happening, but if I look at the Facebook group, because I've, you know, that's part of my daily activity, has been for the last 2 years or so. If I step back a bit and look at it, I think that's what's happening there. It's the same song being played, and people being invited to join in that song, and to share whenever they feel they're out of tune or they can't keep up, and then others will step in and help. It's really been an inspiration, that being on the Facebook group. One of the reasons that I didn't want to be on Facebook to begin with was because of the animosity that's often present. But in this group, that hardly ever happens, in my experience. So I think that would be a place where I really recognize playing together or the singing together in different modalities or in different keys, but still, you know, harmoniously. And I suppose in people's families, that's where that happens too. In my family, it certainly does. So that's where I experience it. And today, with you, in this conversation.
So before we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add that I haven't asked or I haven't mentioned, or something that's important to you that you'd like people to know?
I don't know. I would just like to perhaps focus on listening to the Holy Spirit within. I've been involved in intuitive writing my, you know, like journaling. Some people call it journaling, or some people call it morning pages. And that's been most helpful. Just ask a question and see what comes. And I engage that almost every day. And that's been a mainstay in my life. And I've actually, like I said, I have a website where some of it is published. And but you know, that's not the main reason why I do it. It's just the connection that establishes. And it helps trust that guidance is always there. And if you tap into that guidance in a conscious way, like, you know, open page in your screen, and you type in a question and you feel a message being delivered, that really gives you a sense of there is a connection, there is help, there is guidance being offered, and it's up to me to receive it. And sometimes I say the course is really very straightforward. It's about two things: forgive and rely on inner guidance. And I think forgiveness can be tricky. I mean, it depends on the person, on the background, et cetera, et cetera. But relying on inner guidance is something that's open to everybody. And of course, inner guidance will guide you in forgiveness. So the two are really go together. So if I were to leave your listeners with one message, it would be: rely on your inner guidance. It is there. Thank you.
Beautiful. Yeah. Now, one last thing. How can people reach you if they'd like to reach you?
They can reach me, I suppose, for Facebook, for the Facebook's. Let's discuss A Course in Miracles, and then direct message me there. Or they can mail me, Johanna van Zwet, written as one word, and then affenschwanz at gmail.com. Or they can go to my site, and you might want to put that on the recording. So three ways, really.
Perfect. So you just give me those links and we'll put it in the show notes.
All right.
So thank you, everyone, for listening. Please share about the podcast so more people get to listen to these conversations, because I've had many of them. And each one is very, very powerful and has helped me and has helped others, as I've got feedback about it again and again. So please share about it, subscribe to it, and review the podcast, and reach out to me if you want to be my guest here and share your message and your love and your understanding. So blessings to you all, and thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share. Thank you, Monica.
You're very welcome.